Welcome to the Grappling Grappling Rewind Podcast.
Welcome to bonus episode 2 of the Grappling Rewind Podcast. We do these bonus episodes intermittently when we have a chance to do it, and we like to cover fun topics that are kind of not on the standard weekly shows like previews and recaps. We like to talk about the finer points of BJJ intricacies.
Yeah, and grappling overall.
As always, I'm your host, Maine, joined here with my co-host,
Emil. This week we're going to talk about what does it take to be an outlier? So this kind of emerged from a discussion that Maine and I, more like argument that Maine and I have been having.
I'd say it was a friendly argument. It was yeah. It was definitely a disagreement there.
Yeah, but okay, so Maine starts using the word elite for people and say, okay, well, what does that mean? I think there's different levels, obviously, and I was trying to come up with a word to describe the people who are the standard, the people to beat every single year in, year out, anytime they're competing. They are the standard. They are the people that hold the keys to the championship.
Who's the king? Who's the king of the division?
That's right. And
if you look through all the results for all the world championships, honestly, for this episode, at least for this first section, we're just talking about the gi, and specifically, we're really talking about guys in the gi from 2004 onward.
So about the past 15 years.
Yeah, because if you look past that, it really kind of fucks up our arguments. And in all honesty, it's in a different era of jiu-jitsu.
That's right.
And so 2004 onward is when you see a lot of the modern guys get their first wins in those world championships.
Yeah, 2004 was a bananas year. But before I forget, we sort of settled on calling these people who win the world championships at black belt in adult year in, year out, we start calling them outliers.
Because right. We thought, because I was actually using those as the elite guys, but Emil was like, no. There's a lot of guys that are elite, like constantly in medal contention, constantly doing really well, constantly nipping at the top or being the top guys. He goes, but we need something, a term for guys that are consistently the best guy, like over a course of years. Not a guy that can win a world title or maybe two world titles and be on for that day, but no, a guy that can win multiple world titles, multiple years in a row, and consistently put on that level of dominating performance over a significant course of time.
Right. So let's start off with 2004, which is a crazy year. Absolutely insane. A lot of the people that we're going to be talking about get their first IBJJF world wins here. So the first one is the guy everyone talks about as one of the greatest of all time, Marcelo Garcia.
Gets his first win
in his division
at 82 kilograms in 2004 in the gi. It's first of 5 wins, by the way.
And I remember people talking about this, like he erupted out of nowhere. Like no one saw him coming. And on top of that, this is one of the cases where he shifted how we play jiu-jitsu now, right? Like butterfly guard, arm drags, that came from his series of runs.
Dude, I play butterfly guard. I'm a primary butterfly guard player now.
Yeah.
It's like, and I watch a lot of Marcelo stuff because I love that geek and I love Miguna in the neck and I love the lifts and the way that he's able to transition and lift. He's also, I'm going to use quotes here, a smaller guy. Even though he's at the 82-kilogram division, he's not one of the guys at 94, 100, plus 100. You know, he is on the lower end of those really standout guys initially in this 2004 series we're talking about now.
Right. And, you know, he also starts slapping on guillotines on just about everybody and getting on people's back, choking everyone out. So this is a great year. So that's just the first, right? Then the next weight division up, Braulio Estimo wins his first championship.
First of 3.
Right.
At 88 kilograms.
And then the division above that,
94 kilograms,
Zanchi wins his first of 7 championships, including one absolute.
Yeah. And then the division above that, 100 kilograms,
we have Hodger Gracie making his first of 10 championship wins.
Yeah, so 2004 was a banger year. Plus, it was actually the second year.
Oh, we're not done yet.
Okay, I'm listening.
Because at Absolute, we have Jacare winning his first championship at Absolute from like 3 or 4 weight divisions down.
Yeah, you love this particular victory. So in 2004, Jacare gets his first Absolute victory. And what's really funny about this, not funny at all, about this victory is what makes this victory particularly interesting is that Jacare is in the 88-kilogram division. He is one of, if not the smallest guy in this modern era we're going to talk about, 2004 onward, to ever win an absolute title. Typically, the absolute titles are only ever won by guys in the 94 to 100 kilogram division. Like, it's very rare that a guy below those divisions is able to win an absolute.
As I can see it, he's the only one below, you know, from 2004 onwards.
Yeah, Sanji's the next closest one at 94 kilograms that gets an absolute, but usually it's in the 100 kilogram division or the plus 100 kilogram division are the only guys that are really winning the absolute. So
right.
Whenever you see a smaller guy in small, I'm using air quotes there, I looked up what 88 kilograms was in pounds. It's like 194 pounds.
Yeah.
With the gi, so he was
still pretty big,
walking around at 190, still a pretty big ass dude, but not above 100 kilograms, above, you know, or right at 100 kilograms, like a smaller, in quotes there, of the bigger guys.
Right. So 2004 is kind of like a great, like, watershed year to begin looking at stuff.
And that's kind of what we're talking about. We're calling it the beginning of the modern era, like the beginning of these huge guys going on these big runs that we'd see carry through, you know, the next 10 plus years.
That's right. And then in 2005, to give you an example, it just continues with Andre Galvao getting his first of five championships. So, yeah, this is a great kind of era to begin looking at it. And again, in 2005, you know, this is going back to Jacare as an outlier. He wins for the first time his division at 88 kilograms, and then he wins absolute again.
Yeah.
And this is winning absolute with people like Roderick Gracie and Fabricio Werdum in competition with that.
So if you don't know this match, go back and watch Jacare versus Roderick Gracie. It is a great match, but in this match, Roderick gets Jacare's arm, and Roderick breaks that shit. And Jacare and Roger lets go once he breaks the arm, and Jacare gets up, shoves his arm back in his gi, and keeps going.
He never tapped. And
in the rules at that time, you don't tap. If you don't tap, you keep going.
Right. And he didn't do, there might have been like a, I don't know what the rules on verbal tap was. He didn't do it. So
he let him break his arm and then shoves his arm back in his gi and avoids Hodger for the last like minute and a half or something.
Something like that. And then he was already up on points.
And so he gets a points victory. He beats him on points after Hodger broke his fucking arm. And he's like, cool, I'm the champion now.
Which is very contentious in the community. Like, a lot of people think that's whack. Like, if you break someone's arm.
And honestly, as a white and blue belt, like, I still go back and forth on this in my head. I always honestly forget if this is the 04 or 05 victory. I always forget which one that he gets his arm broken in.
So here's my Emil's take on this is, it's fucking awesome. He's the smallest dude to have won absolute. And Roger Gracie also goes on to win 10 championships. Like, I'm not worried about Hodger getting robbed from that year, you know?
Right. Like, yeah, I think it was the 04 year is when he breaks his arm. Just looked it up. It's the 04 year. So go back and watch that. If you have never had the privilege of seeing that match, it's all over YouTube.
Yeah.
Go back and watch it.
It's an insane moment in jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because it prompted a rule change that basically, like, look, if your shit gets fucked up and we see it gets fucked up, like, we call the match.
Right.
And it goes back and forth in the community, like, is that a legit win, even though you got hurt, but you didn't tap because that was the rule? It's an interesting kind of argument to be made, but regardless, the scoreboard still says that he won.
Yeah, and so, I think Jacare is an outlier, like, you know, hands down.
Just because he has the three world titles, two at absolute, one at weight class.
And I know we're not talking about no-gi this time, but he also has ADCC championships as well. So, like, yeah, he's incredible. So, moving on, we have Andre Galvao, by the way, for his first win in 2005, is only down at 82 kilograms. I forgot how small he started off.
He didn't start out. So he's another guy. Him and Leandro Lau are two guys we're going to look at. And as they win world titles, you'll watch them climb up the weight classes. And it's really funny. We get to Lau a little later. I think it's really comical to watch him, like, pop, pop, move weight class, pop, pop, move weight class. And then you see him consistently moving up the weight class all the way till he gets to the absolute. But Galvao's another guy that starts at the 82 kilogram division when he wins his first world title in 2005.
That's right. And so these guys, you know, the guys that we mentioned now are really kind of the first outliers. And they just keep winning and winning and winning. Sanjay's winning again, like almost year after year.
In 2005 is Hodger's second victory
right.
in a row.
Right.
And then we move on to 2006. And let's say anything else in 2005.
Yeah.
We have Hodger's third victory in a row. And then
Sanjay wins his division and absolute.
Yeah. He's another guy. And this is, again, in 2006 in the 84-kilogram division, Sanjay takes it and he takes the absolute. He's another guy that's not in that 100 under 100-kilogram or 100-kilogram division that takes an absolute. He's one of the few along with Jacare. And really, I don't think there's anyone Adolfo Vieira wins it again in 2011 at 94 kilograms, but most of the other guys are in that either 100 or 100 above 100-kilogram division.
That's right. And then in 2007, we have Bruno Malfacine's first out of 10 in his division.
Yeah. Roosterweight too. So he's when we talk about Bruno, remember that Bruno is at the smallest division. He's at the 57 kilogram division, and he does not cut weight to make that division. He's the roosterweights. Those are the little guys, and so he has 10 victories from 2007 on to 2018 in his weight class.
Yeah,
he's the only guy to be that victorious in his weight class, and a guy that big isn't going to do absolute. So that is particularly impressive, especially being at the smallest weight class and not cutting to make that weight class.
That's right. In 2007, also, we have, for the last of his five championships, someone who's a little bit from the older guard that I want to talk about briefly is Hobson Mora. He is an amazing small guy jiu-jitsu. If you want to see, like, incredible, efficient half-guard work, which, to be honest, we don't see that much of anymore, you know.
Not like, a whole. Some guys use it. So Hobbs Moore actually gets his first victory in 97.
Yeah.
And then at Roosterweight, and then later in his career, he moves up to 64 kilograms, one division up, to get the remaining four of his world championships. I love Hobson for a bunch of reasons. He's got a really good interview on Grappling Union podcast. But another reason is he is the picture of Jeff Glover knee barring him.
Yep.
That's him and Jeff Glover.
Yeah.
He just
totally
no sells it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a picture of Jeff Glover just trying to blow
Hobson's
knee backwards. And it looks like it's almost blown backwards. And he's just stone face.
Yeah.
And he eventually gets out of it. And that's actually from a really old super fight.
Yeah.
And actually, Hobson is recently on the Grappling Union podcast and in depth goes and talks about that match.
If I remember correctly, he regretted not tapping to that, right?
I think he said, I knew what the position was, I knew where we were, and I knew that, like,
he didn't have
it. I knew that, like, it was tight, but I could get, I think, it was really interesting interview if one of you listened to it.
Maybe I'm misremembering, but I remember, I could have sworn it was him talking about how, like, long-term, like, no selling, kind of, like, he had.
There's been a lot of guys that have said that.
Yeah, exactly.
They've been like, yeah, I mean, when I was young, I held out, and then, like, now that I'm not young, my shit's hella fucked up.
Yep.
I feel like that's the path that I'm gonna go through, except I'm currently kind of young and still super fucked up.
And a purple belt.
Yeah. And for the record, like, if I stand up right now, my leg is so fucked up right now, if I stand up, it causes me immense pain, which isn't great at 27.
And by the way, Hobson's the man. I briefly skipped over one of the most important outliers in 2006, who gets his second win in 2007, and that's Cobrinha.
Cobrinha. You love you some Cobrinha.
Dude, Cobrinha is like, it's, I mainly love that, like, he and Hoffa, like, I think this is really one of the probably longest rivalries in terms of having two outliers in the same division duking it out. Like, those two guys, like, that's
yeah.
just
so we're talking
incredible.
About right now, we're talking about the 70 kilogram division IBJJF World Championships from 2006 on to 2017. Basically, these two dudes go back and forth, and there's one year where Taquinho wins too, but that kind of fucks up our argument. They go back and forth, and so you look at two outliers in the same division that are able to go back and forth. There's literally a whole Wikipedia article on these two guys and their rivalry. I think it's a section in I think you can click to it from either person's article, Hoffa or Cobrinha, basically like their rivalry between the two guys. And it has all the times they met, how each person won, the outcome of each match. And these guys to this day still aren't huge fans of each other.
Oh, no. In 12 years in the 70-kilogram division, only once did someone not named Cobrinha or Rafa Mendes win? That's insane.
Yeah.
You know, like, those two are...
That's rooster weight levels of domination.
Yeah.
That's Bruno Malfacine levels.
Yeah.
It's great. Another really interesting... Both those guys are outliers. And again, it's really easy here looking at the chart to pick out these outliers, but I think a little later we'll talk about guys that are like elite guys and like why they're not outliers. And it's like what the things that they weren't able to win and the championships they weren't able to attain, like they're still the top guys and elite in the elite of the elite competitors, but they're not that next level outlier guy that could just beat everyone year over year over year.
So in 2007, we also have Lucas Lepree winning his first out of five championships.
Yep.
And we have Rafael Lovato Jr. winning, being, you know, at this point, only the third American to win.
Yeah. He also grand slammed it that year.
Yeah. And so he's a great example of someone who's incredible and is leaving his mark in jiu-jitsu, who's elite, but not an outlier. Right?
From the performance perspective at black belt.
Right.
Like, really, I think to be an outlier, you have... We're looking at guys that win world championships. Like, in the gi, that is our metric for outlier. Like, there are a lot of guys that, like, could come and potentially beat some of these guys, but unless they competed at the time, at that event, in that year, like, they cannot get that title. And that's a kind of thing we kind of gloss over a lot, is levels of competition.
Right.
There are a lot of guys that are absolutely amazing grapplers, but they don't compete very much, or they just do super fights, or they just compete in this particular rule set. And to be the outlier guy, you also have to show up.
Right.
And you have to have been tested at that level, with that level of competition on this world stage repeatedly, and shown that under pressure in this brutal tournament setting, you can perform and do it.
Right.
So that precludes guys as well.
This isn't a perfect system. For example, in 2008, we have someone who I think is a great example of, like, someone who's kind of on the cusp, right? Like, you don't really know. And this is Kai Otero.
Like, yeah.
He has two championships.
And we're talking about in the gi as well.
Right.
But it's kind of weird. Like, you look at – I don't want to cut your point off here, but you look at Kyle. Kyle has two championships. He's the only other guy not named Bruno Malfacine that has a victory from 2007 onward in the rooster weight division. But he just can't get past Bruno a lot.
Right.
And so you look at his no-gi world title. That dude wins the no-gi world title. Like, he won it continuously from 08 to 2017.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think 2006 was the first year they had the no-gi worlds.
Yeah.
So he won literally at under 61 kilograms and under 54 kilograms every single world title you could almost in no-gi. But we're not talking about no-gi now. We're talking about in the gi. And because he couldn't consistently beat Bruno, it kind of puts him on that cusp. Like, he is an elite of elite competitor, but we're just arguing about, is he an outlier?
That's right. So, you know, now we're on to now in 2008, we're still seeing, you know, the people that we talked about earlier, Andre Galvao, Hadra Gracie, Zanji Wins,
Cobrinha. Yep.
You know, those are the outliers that we see year in, year out.
Yeah, Sanji wins his fifth and sixth world title, once at weight, once at absolute.
Yeah, so that's his second absolute. You know, and then in 2009, we have the introduction of...
In 08, we also have Hadra winning his sixth world title. We kind of keep glossing over Hadra.
Well, at this point, we're going to be mentioning his name for a while, right? So,
yeah, 10 fucking times.
Yeah, if we gloss over, you know, it's just out of efficiency. But now in 2009, we have Gui Mendes winning the first. I didn't know that he was the first of the Mendes brothers to win.
That. No shit.
So it isn't until 2010.
It's like a learning process for us, too.
Yeah. So Gui, by the way, he wins four championships, which is this monster.
Yep.
And Hafa in 2010 wins his first out of six.
They are definitely the winningest brothers in jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hands down.
Yeah, that's
especially in the gi, which, again, we're not talking about the gi right now.
And also in just absolutely monster divisions.
You know? We have in the 64-kilogram and the 70-kilogram divisions. Like, those two dudes, again, were the dudes to beat for the years that they were competing.
So then moving on, we got in 2011, we see, you know, much of the same with a couple new faces.
We also see Marcelo get his last Gi World title in 2011.
But now we have a new one introduced, a new outlier, Rodolfo Vieira, right? And this past year was me learning really about Rodolfo, you know, in terms of his sheer dominance.
Well, because he hasn't really been competing since really you've been doing jiu-jitsu or I've been doing jiu-jitsu. Like,
right.
He has been primarily – I've known Rodolfo as an MMA fighter.
Right.
Since I've really been doing jiu-jitsu. I knew he was a multiple-time world champion. I've seen the footage. I've seen him, like, compete and roll. But he has been competing in MMA since I've really been engaged in this stuff from a sport perspective.
Yeah, to see him come back after 5 years and beat world champion Muhammad Ali in the Gi was just awesome.
Yeah, we saw him this last year in Black Belt CBD in the finals take on Muhammad Ali, the current world champion at the weight class. So Rodolfo has all of his wins at 94 kilograms. And his one absolute as well. And Muhammad Ali, for the first year this year, 2018, took the world title at 94 kilograms. So to see these two guys match up again, and it was the first time Rodolfo had been in the Gi in 5 years, and show that, hey, I can still put up against a world-class level guy and beat him, again, wasn't in the brutal tournament format of the IBJJF World Championships, but it was still – the rule set was the same.
That's right. And this year also is the year that he wins – so not only does he win his first division, he takes absolute too. So he's also, in the 94 kilogram.
In the two giant guy divisions, winning a world championship.
And giant guy would be 100 kilogram and 100 plus kilogram.
Yeah, sorry, the giant guy divisions. I put in quotes there as my ass sits at like featherweight or some shit.
That's right. So 2012, we have Rafa Mendes continuing his domination. We have Leandro Lowe winning his first out of six titles.
And the funny thing about Lowe here is Lowe is in 76 kilogram division here.
So Lowe, I think Lowe is really impressive because of how much he shifts in weight the years.
Also in game. Yeah. Like, you see his game as he goes from 2012 at, 76 kilograms all the way up to his most recent year at, I think he was at 94 kilograms, and then entered in the absolute and got the title from Bruschetta as a gift of friendship
right. This
year. But Lowe, I mean, let's talk about Lowe for a second here, because 2012 he gets the victory. 2013 same division, gets the victory. 2014 division up, 82 kilograms, Leandro Lowe gets the victory. Next year, 2015 at 88 kilograms, Leandro Lowe gets the victory, and then he has a year off, and then this year he's in the finals with Muhammad Ali, gets injured, and then is in the absolute finals with Bruschetta, and Bruschetta gives him the title.
Yeah. So that's Leandro's another outlier, for sure.
Especially to go up that much weight. Like, we saw Galvao do that, but not to the extent that Lowe did it.
Right.
Lowe starts a division lower and technically has his final world championship victory in the absolute.
That's right. His
most recent one, not final.
So in 2014, Gi Mendes wins his last out of four championships. Rafa wins his fourth. Lucas Lepree wins his second. We have Jamilo Barral winning his fifth out of five.
Yeah, we've kind of glossed over him for some reason. I'm not sure why.
But he's
we managed to miss him for some reason.
Yeah. I guess it's 2012 to 2015, kind of like we're in that range right now.
Well, he's also in the divisions with Galvao and Estima. And Jacques Ray, like, he's in, again, all these divisions are absolutely stacked. You look at the level of guys that's able to repeatedly get on this list and win over and over and over again, and it's just crazy to see who's able to pull the titles out.
That's right. So, and at this point, Rafa and Gi have retired when we start going 2015 onwards to 2018.
Rafa didn't retire until 2016.
Right.
He retired after his sixth world title in 2016. So, again, definitely outlier status.
Right. And now we're in this interesting era where, many of these guys have retired or are retiring.
Or
right?
getting so, up there in years. Like
so
guys like
Bruno just retired.
Yep.
Now, obviously, Cabrinha just retired.
Yep.
It's been a few years that the Mendes brothers retired. We have...
You ready, Emil?
I'm just dying over here. We have Bruschetta also retiring. So
did he retire?
I thought he Yeah.
He's running out of fingers, but I don't think he retired.
Oh, he didn't?
I thought
he just said he was done, right?
No,
I thought he said he has nothing left to prove.
Well, he doesn't have anything left to prove, but he's going to continue to prove it,
oh,
I thought.
Oh, okay. All right.
He ran out of fingers last year, so, okay. Like, who are we really bullshitting? Or, sorry, this year. Sorry, okay. Last year.
Maybe I'm confusing that, like, he gave the championship to Leandro, and that is when he said, I have nothing to lose here.
Oh, yeah, I have nothing to prove. I think that's what it is. Like, yeah. I gave it to Leandro because he's like, look, I already have a bunch of these things. I've got nothing to prove. We know I'm the best. I'll give it to him, even knowing that I'm the best.
So really, right now, we have Buchecha as, you know, really one of the greatest outliers, you know, between him and Hodger. Yeah. I think their super fight kind of established who was dominant there. But
yeah, because you saw Buchecha literally get finished by Hodger.
Right.
Which is just absolutely crazy.
We
and
have
so,
Leandro Lowe as an established outlier.
Yep.
We have Lucas Lepre as an established outlier, and maybe Mike Musumeci, you know, like,
yeah,
so he's won two in a row. He won in 2017 and in 2018 in a just brutal division. What is that, featherweight, whatever, 64 kilograms. If he wins again, I think that's, you know, he cements
for
himself.
Some reason our metric for outlier here seems to be three world champion victories in the gi at IBJJF.
It just looking over it, it seems like if you win three or more, then there's something there, you know. Like,
yeah, they're the guys that you know that you recognize immediately as like, oh, that's the guy. Like, yeah,
right.
That's the guy. Like, you have guys like, there's a bunch of guys that have one victory that are, again, outstanding competitors. Like guys like Arifrias, like always on the cusp. He has one world champion victory. Paulo Miao, always on the cusp, has one world champion victory. Like you have, like Shane Jemihill Taylor. Has one world championship victory. An amazing grappler, but like we just don't know if he's going
to
be there yet. It's not saying that like we're going to preclude him from being like an outlier, but at this point in time, like we don't know if Musumeci is going to get there, and we don't know if Shane's going to get there. We also don't know if guys like Azaki Behance or like any of the guys that already have won, like Mergali.
Right.
Like we don't know. If you look at Mergali's current gi record, like he is a monster. We talked about him last week. Like if he beats you, he wins by submission. Like he's a monster this last year, but he's got a couple losses too.
That's right. And so it's a very interesting time because, you know, there's definitely divisions where we don't know, like the outliers are missing now.
Yeah.
We don't know, like that was Bruno Malfacine's
Dude, especially
division.
Like you look at 57 kilograms, Bruno's division.
Right.
You look at 100 kilograms. Like look at the last couple of years, like Hodger, you know, gets his last title in 2010, and then it's been Leo Nogueira, Bernardo Faria, Adolfo Vieira, Bernardo Faria, Alexander Cerrone, Erberth, Felipe Pena. Like,
yeah.
It's been kind of a little bit of a revolving door back and forth between a couple guys.
That's right. Now in 2017, or really 2016 and onwards, there's no clear person who's, you know, the guy to beat.
The dude at that division. Like,
it's
again,
the same thing with
88 kilograms.
Yep.
It's like you have Leandro Lowe getting his last victory, but then, you know, he's not in that division anymore. He's moved up to 94
the
kilogram division. And then you have Galvao getting his victory in 2017. Galvao's done now. He's retired. You got Barbosa winning it this last year with first victory.
I think Barbosa's going to be an outlier.
Oh, yeah. I think I can definitely see him being an outlier. But you just see, you start to see those guys that put on those that level of performance. And like, yeah, Hulk could definitely be a dude that could have a run.
I could see him doing a run.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's...
But
the
I could see Muhammad Ali. I could see, again, if you win a world title, especially your first world title...
Well, I don't know. I mean, Muhammad Ali's really good. Like, if Leandro didn't get injured...
That would have been a really interesting match.
Right. So, I think they did go at it. I think that's the match that Leandro got injured in.
Yeah, it
is.
Because he snapped him down and he hurt his... Leandro, like, landed on his arm and hurt his arm.
Right,
like, that was the match. So, it's like, that could be a really good scrap. But, again, you get a world title, especially your first world title. We don't know what's coming next year. Like, it's anyone's game. A year is a long time. We've seen guys, you know, look unstoppable the year after they win the world title. We've also seen guys kind of have a rough year, like Erberth wins in 2017. 2018 wasn't really a great year for Erber Santos.
he picked up towards the end.
He did pick up, but you saw him have a really, we had that rib injury or the neck injury, whatever injury he had at the beginning of the year at the Euros. And like,
same thing with Nicolas Marigali. Like, he wins in 2017 and then, like, just, you know, he has amazing performances in 2018, but just doesn't make that breakthrough.
Right. He looks really, really good, but he's like, are you an outlier yet? And he's another guy that very well could be an outlier, but we just don't have enough data on him yet to, like, substantially, like, oh, yeah, he's the guy. Right. Because we just don't have a historic level of – he's definitely elite. Like, you win one world title, you're elite.
Yeah.
No question about it. Even if it was, like, an odd year or something happened or the next guy in your division got hurt, if you win a world title, you're elite. I would honestly say guys that, you know, can place – at a world level, are elite.
100%.
And then you have, like, your really good competitive black belts. Then you have, like, your black belts that are, like, semi-competitive. Then you have your hobbyist black belts. And then you have, like,
Scrubs. No, I'm just kidding.
No, you're not. But that's true, though. There's nothing wrong with enjoying jiu-jitsu and not being a goddamn world beater.
Yeah.
Like, jiu-jitsu for everyone. If you are willing to, you know, get beat on for 8 years and then, like, deal with that.
I'm a scrub, so
we're both kind of scrubs, Emil.
Nah, you compete. I mean, your knees are all fucked up right now, but
I'm kind of a scrub. Like, I compete, I do good when I compete, but I don't compete at, like, a world level or anywhere close to that.
Sure. But we love watching that shit.
It's awesome.
So
let's go through, like, the big guys that are absolutely no question, and IBJJF. And this list has been laid out very nicely for us. 11-time world champion Marcos Almeida.
Buchecha
with 11 world titles. There are two guys with 10 world championships, Hodger Gracie and Bruno Malfacine, both outliers.
I'm going to quickly interject and think that I'm going to say that Bruno Malfacine's, I think, divisional dominance is more impressive. But, you know,
that's
a whole other debate.
Well, it's such a length of time to be victorious in that division.
Yeah.
Like, that's the difference. It's like every other person.
And,
like,
he doesn't have a size advantage on the people that he's winning, right? So Hodger Gracie and Buchecha both have 5 absolutes that they win. And, you know, when you're in the biggest division, like, if you're in the 100-plus kilogram, like, yeah, okay, so you have a size advantage.
You hate on big guys hard, Emil.
Always.
I'm not going to publicly do it, but privately I will.
So, anyway. Bruno's the man. Sad that he retired, but I'm curious to see what happens in his division.
I'm curious, actually, what he does in MMA, because he's still fighting MMA. I'm curious to see, like, as a little guy fighting in Asia, like, what he does, because he puts on some goddamn exciting fights.
It's going to be interesting because, you know, there's a crop of really talented jiu-jitsu people who have started to transition to MMA.
It's just the next generation. I mean, we've seen guys all throughout.
It happens. Yeah, it happens throughout. But, like,
yeah, Jacques Roy did it. Galvao did it. Who else has done it? Adolfo did it. Hodger did it. Like, most of the guys, because that's where the money is. Even Marcelo took a fight.
Yep.
And it was a weird result. He got cut.
Pretty much all of them hated it. Like,
yeah, no, most of them don't like it. But,
like, Jacare is, like, you know, he's like one of the few that still is going. Like, that's also beast. But anyway, to keep going down the list, we have 7-time world champion Zanji.
You always want to put that Z on there.
Sanji.
By the way, I give you shit because it took me 3 fucking years to get his name right. So for once, I'm the guy when I have the name right.
So.
Suck it, Josh. 6-time world champion. We got Rafa Mendez and Leandro Lowe. Then we have a bunch of 5-time world champions: Salo Herrera, Hobson Mora, Marcelo Garcia, Adolfo Vieira, Jamelo Bahal, Hubin Charles, Andre Galvao, and Lucas Lepre. And then we have 4-time world champions: Hoyler Gracie, again from a different era, but we didn't really touch on the guys from back in the 90s and the early 2000s.
Right.
Because, again, I don't really have a ton of the basis of history, and that would be a lot more research for me to do.
Actually, if you look at these lists, it's not until you get the 4-time, really, only all of the people that we've just read are their reigns began and around 2004 and onwards, with the exception of Salo Ribeiro, Hobson Mura, Hoyler Gracie at 4, Roberto Magalhães at 4. Fabio Gurgel at 4. But everyone else that we've read... Oh, sorry.
Fabio Gurgel.
Everyone else is from 2004 onwards. So I do think that there is something there.
Yeah, and given that's a little biased because the World Championships for the Gi and IBJJF only begin in 1996. So,
but there's something about 2004 and onwards where we start to see, you know, you have jiu-jitsu has begun to attract those people that are not only super athletic, very smart, but also obsessed. You know, like it's that combination.
You start to get the crazy athletes.
Yes.
In 04, you start to see the dudes that are like, oh, you're a crazy athlete that's been doing it since you were a little kid. And like, this is your sport.
Right.
This is your soccer. This is the thing that you do amazingly well.
So the other four, by the way, I don't want to skip these guys. The other four-time world champions are Gi Mendez and Bernardo Faria.
Yeah.
So they're all, everyone that we listed is tremendous. Most of those guys, I would say three quarters of the guys that we just read off, are from 2004 onwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's something that sparked in jiu-jitsu where it began to attract
there's a large enough base.
Yeah. Probably it's just attracted a large enough base where you start to get more people like that.
Yeah.
So all of these people are tremendous. And, you know, I'm really excited to see now. I feel like now that it's 2018. We have a new, 2019. Man, I am fucked up.
You're having a rough day. We're doing this another midweek recording. Not used to recording on a Wednesday, Emil.
2019, and I feel like a lot of the divisions are a little more of them are up in the open.
A lot of stuff is wide open right now. We have a lot of guys. Like, look at this last year. In 2018, we had 5 guys that got their first world title this year.
Right.
Like, it is wide open for a bunch of guys.
Right.
Like, this is the first year in a while that we had less returning champions than new victors. Like, the only returning champions we had were Bruno, now retired, Michael Musumeci, second-time world champion, Lucas Lepre, and Bushesha and Lowe. Like, everyone else was a new world champion, about half and half. I'm not going to do the math on it because I can't do math, but like, everything is wide open. It's going to be an exciting year.
Yeah.
We're about to have the Euros in a week. Again, we're kind of going to date the show. The bonus episodes almost don't fit in with like the regular chronology of the show because usually we cover stuff week to week, but the bonus episodes are kind of standalone.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really talk about that much. Like, you can go back and listen to the bonus episode that we talked about Craig Jones and Gordon and them, and it doesn't really date itself as much as the rest of the shows do.
Right. And, you know, again, like the people that we just listed, you know, we are reading through multiple time world champions. And they're still really incredible jiu-jitsu. The amazing thing about the outliers is they're incredible. But they're still brilliant people that are, like, at the elite status, too. You know, like, just amazing jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, we didn't talk about, you know, the guys that are consistently in second and third place and fourth. Like, we didn't talk about those guys because there's plenty of dudes that are absolutely elite grapplers that just aren't on this list or just aren't on this list yet.
Yeah,
that's the cool thing about jiu-jitsu. You have certain guys that, like, all of a sudden, a couple years into their black belt, will just turn a corner. You see it less now, but it happens.
Right, and I mean, just think about that. Like, Joao Miao is incredible, and he's not on here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he hasn't even won a title.
Yep, his brother has won.
Is incredible. He has won, right? Like, those guys are brilliant at jiu-jitsu. And
well, Paulo technically has two. If we want to make an argument.
Yeah.
Like, I don't give a fuck about drug testing. Right. He has two world titles. But again,
but even then,
jeez, the dog just scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, even then, you know, even with arguably two as brilliant as the Miao brothers are yet, they haven't cemented that outlier status.
Yeah, they haven't cemented it. Definitely, again, they've cemented the elite status. Like,
right.
They're elite competitors. Like, they are the favorites to win almost anything that they enter on any given day.
Yeah.
But elite doesn't make you an outlier. Elite is a level of competition and performance. Outlier is a level of dominance over time.
Right. So if you're new to jiu-jitsu and this is in terms of watching it, you know, maybe you practice it, you haven't seen, you're not familiar with too many of the people, you want to start getting into watching it.
If we listed off a bunch of names, you have no idea, like, who they are. Pick a guy that is an outlier, ideally, or pick a guy that you like watching.
Yeah.
Honestly, and like, go through, look at their social media, like, look at what they're on, look what they're competing on, and follow them and see what they do. And they will, you will see guys compete in a variety of different rule sets, and you'll see certain guys. The guys we've listed just now in kind of the previous segment are all guys that are really, really successful in IBJJF. Most of those guys are pretty successful in whatever they decide to do. All right. The guys that are outliers are pretty much always successful in everything they decide to do.
Right. And, you know, that's important. We stuck with Gi Worlds because IBJJF Gi Worlds because there's so much depth there already. But there's, you know, ADCC, that's a whole different category. And you have people, you know.
Oh, yeah. And you'll see a whole different selection. We'll do probably a show, another bonus show down the line here where we just talk about, like, ADCC outliers. Like, the outliers we just talked about are only outliers that are in the Gi.
But it's most impressive when, yeah, they can switch to different rule sets and still dominate, right? Like, seeing Marcelo's IBJJF, you know, World Championship runs is incredible. Watching his ADCC runs is just freaking, like, it's amazing.
Like, he's outstanding in the Gi, and then you watch him in no-gi, and you're like, oh, goddamn, he's exciting, too.
Yeah.
And so, like, you very quickly will pick, there's certain events that we cover. Again, we try to cover on this show pretty much all broadcast professional grappling events, and then the major events for UAE JJF, for IBJJF, and then any other sort of major event or major promotion that comes up. We try to cover events that pay out their competitors because we think that's, I think that's really important, especially at the top level. Like, these guys are professional athletes. I think they should be paid as professional athletes because they perform and they train like professional athletes. So you'll see guys and you'll see a rule set that you find most exciting. Because Emil and I watch all of these events, we have our preferences. Like, although we cover all this stuff, I openly state, like, my preference isn't IBJJF rule sets. Like, I don't find that produces the best, most exciting action.
So do you want to talk about these rule sets?
Yeah, let's talk about some rule sets. So we have a small list of promotions and basically rule set types. They're all are significantly different. Each one has its pro, each one has its con. Some are far more viewer friendly, some are far less viewer friendly. None of them are bad or good inherently. It's just this style of jiu-jitsu and action that they are trying to promote in their rule set. So let's start with the Super Fight Gold Standard, or at least for a long time, a Super Fight Gold Standard, EBI.
Yeah, EBI
for a tournament setting, EBI has the most consistently utilized Super Fight rule set that we see.
Right. And, you know, Eddie Bravo came into this, you know, his approach was he wanted submissions, he wanted excitement, he wanted, you know, people to go in for finishes.
He wanted people to be interested in watching jiu-jitsu. So he tried to create a rule set that was basically, hey, I want to broadcast jiu-jitsu. I want to make it fun. I want guys to finish each other. How do we do it?
So also, it's not traditionally, like, you can't call it technically sub-only, but the way to win a match in regulation time is only by submission.
Right. So you have a 10-minute match. Is it 10 minutes now?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I should have looked that up. 10-minute match, and then they've modified the rules since the initial event. It used to be you'd have a 10-minute match. If there's no submission, you start in what's called overtime rules. And then overtime rules, you start on the back, or you start on an arm, and then you say go, and either you get riding time, where the guy can't escape, or you get a submission, where the guy submits the guy. And so in the preliminary matches now, they used to have 3 rounds of this, and the winner after 3 rounds had the most amount of time, or had the fastest submission, won. Now in the preliminary rounds of these tournaments, they only have one. That's a modification they've made because the events got really, really, really fucking long sometimes.
They also cut down the time, too.
Yeah, you have a maximum of 5 minutes now. So they've modified their rule set in order to promote it to try to make it more action-friendly.
So the matches will predominantly end, you know, regulation time, you know, whether or not it ends in a submission. Overall, the matches in overtime will frequently end in a submission, but sometimes it just comes down to ride time.
Right.
So the benefits to this system is that it encourages, you know, presumably encourages submissions.
Yeah, I think it definitely initially, and whenever you see a new rule set adopted, the first, like, two events that runs usually work pretty fucking well.
And But as with everything, people adapt to a rule set. Uh-huh. I remember specifically hearing Danaher talk about them working on EBI-specific scenarios, right? So he was, the specific scenarios being overtime, right? So he was working with Eddie Cummings a lot and Gordon Ryan and Gary Tonin.
And they talk about at length in an interview, Bravo talks about it. He goes, yeah, Donahue's asked me these weird questions like, all right, what constitutes an escape? Like, is this an escape? Does this count as an escape? And Eddie was like, we hadn't thought about that yet.
Right.
Like, he's like, I don't know. It's like, I had to see it. When I see it, I'll know if it's an escape
and
or not.
This is what happens is that rule sets get optimized, right? So yeah. Right now, you know, EBI is still really great. We are starting to see a lot more, you know, I feel like I've seen more ride time.
Oh, yeah. As guys matches. Get better at defending the back and defending the arm because they know if your match goes the full length, like, you get guys that are better at just playing to the rule set. Now, we've seen plenty of matches now where a guy gets fucking crushed for regulation time and then is gifted the back.
Yep.
And it's like, okay. And so Emil and I have our feelings about that, but that's the rule set. And that's like, doesn't matter if the guy gets crushed for 5 or 8 or 10 minutes or however long, because there's a bunch of organizations that use this rule set. Doesn't matter how long they get crushed for. Like, after time runs out, cool, you get the guys back.
But it is a nice rule set in that it doesn't really involve, it's one of the rule sets that doesn't involve points, right?
Or decisions.
Right.
So it's like quantifiably at the end, no matter what your rule set are, you get a dude that wins and there's no question he won as long as the rules are followed, like the referee doesn't make a mistake. Like, so that is the really nice thing about that rule set. But the con is we've seen more people learn how to game the rule set.
Right.
And so now.
But it's still the gold standard in terms of a lot
tournament
of
style in quotes, their submission only format.
So, you know, we have other organizations.
Yeah, we have, like, the Fight to Win rule set. I want to say it's one of the gold standards of a straight super fight submission event, basically.
Right.
It's for black belts, for title matches, it's a 10-minute bout. In the gi, it's IBJJF rules, which are, again, the gold standard of gi rules. And in no gi, it's everything legal, including slams.
Yeah, and when Main says IBJJF rules, he means in terms of what submissions are legal. There are still no points in Fight to Win, which is
right.
Nice. It's you're gauged by your submission attempts.
Right. So Fight to Win rules, they're looking for submissions and they're looking for action.
That's right.
So I like Fight to Win's rule set. If you get two guys that are willing to play to the rules, there's very, very exciting matches, which is why they are what Emil and I term as a broadcast level super fight event. Their goal is to put on a show and to entertain people, so they have a rule set that facilitates that. It might not facilitate, in quotes, they're like, the best jiu-jitsu, because it's not 10 minutes of a dude trying to pass the guard, which is really fucking boring
right.
to watch. Like, it's interesting, but after a while, like, I don't want to watch 35 matches where a guy is trying to get 2 points to sweep or 3 points to pass the guard.
Right.
So Fight to Win, it rewards people for being active and going for submissions. If you're on the bottom, it doesn't matter if you're going for subs.
Also, it allows slams.
I'd love me some slams.
That's right.
So it's really interesting. I've talked to a bunch of guys on Fight to Win. We've gone to a bunch of Fight to Win events, and I've talked to a bunch of the competitors. I'm surprised about how many guys, like, don't like the slams. And not like don't like it, they just don't think it's good jiu-jitsu, so they don't do it. It's really funny. I'm like, oh, I hate for the slams. Like, oh, I don't like slams. I don't think it's good technique. And I go like, what? Like, it's always surprising me to see the level of competitor that, like, just prefers not to slam. Like, they don't care if, like, the guy's going to slam them because they have the technique to stop it, but they don't like to slam because they don't think it's good technique.
Yeah.
And I'm always surprised about that.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that, you know, but don't want to stray too much away from the rule sets, you know. And it's interesting to see slams, you know. It
yeah.
keeps people honest in terms of, like, you know, latching onto a triangle when they're getting hoisted
in
the air.
It keeps it more, not, I'm going to say realistic, but
it's
like,
you know,
the defense to a dude locking a triangle, and there's a bunch of defenses, but one of the defenses is I stand up and slam the dude off of me. You know, it's a very valid defense. Is the best defense? Probably not. But does it work a lot? Definitely. How do you get out of a guy's guard that's just holding guard? You slam him and slam him and slam him. Eventually that guy's going to go, maybe I don't want to hold this guard, or, oh, his leg slips a little bit. Like, it facilitates action, and there's plenty of guys we've seen that are on the bottom getting passed, getting moved around, but they are throwing up legitimate sub attempts that require defense, and so they get a victory. And if you look at that match as a whole, you're like, yeah, he got his guard passed a bunch, but the other guy was kind of positionally controlling him, but at no point put up any offense. You know, he had positionally dominated him, but the other guy on the bottom was going for an arm or going for a neck or going for a leg. It's like that guy was winning that match per the rule set. So you get a lot of guys that try to play a straight up points game in Fight to Win, and there's no points.
Yeah.
So the most interesting matches are ones where both guys realize, oh, there are no points here. I will lose if I pass the guy's guard 8 times and he throws up a tight choke. Like, that choke has more validity in Fight to Win. So you get some really interesting matches. Again, it has its pros, it has its cons. Sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it puts on, as you said, really entertaining matches. But let's talk about the gold standard for no-gi in terms of overall competition.
I'm looking at the rules. I'm trying to figure out what you're going to talk about next.
ADCC, man.
I thought you were talking about Quintet.
No. Well, I'm talking about in terms of prestige.
Okay, so we're going to prestige here.
Right.
Okay.
No-gi prestige, ADCC is hands out.
And ADCC is some of the screwiest rules as well.
Screwiest rules. And interestingly enough, when I spoke to Matthias Lutz after his match at SAGC 7, he said hands down ADCC was his favorite rule set. ADCC...
Also allows slams.
Yeah. Also allows slams.
Which is really uncommon. There's not many rule sets. I think Fight to Win and ADCC are the only events of only rule sets we have that are, you know, principally Super Fight or big tournament rule sets that allow slams. Like, it's relatively uncommon.
Right. So ADCC has sort of, you know, it's a continuous match, but there's a first half and a second half to the match. In the first half, there are no points. So
it's supposed to facilitate action and, like, submission attempts.
That's right.
Because, like, you can get in a bad position. Doesn't really matter because there's no points.
Right.
You're just going for the sub. And then at halfway through the match, somebody will yell, points, and it becomes a points match. And the ADCC points are different. They reward different things for different positions. They reward look up ADCC points. They're super screwy. And because I'm probably never going to compete in ADCC, I don't need to know them offhand. I don't need to know them until the week before we preview ADCC.
That's right.
That's really what happens for ADCC.
They weight the points differently. But they also have an overtime, you know. I remember, like, learning this, that, like, the match time can vary, like, or rather the period that you're in has vastly different rules, and you can have three different rule sets, basically. Yeah. So
they have an interesting rule set, and again, they're the gold standard for that prestige for tournaments, for that no-gi tournament.
Right. And they are pretty incredible. But we can talk about, you mentioned it before, my overall favorite rule set, Quintet.
Well, I think Quintet kind of, it cheats a little bit.
You're right, it's apples to oranges.
It can do something that none of these other events that we talk about do, because it's a team battle format. Okay, so Viana said it best. Alex Viana, give him credit every time for this.
Yeah,
it's you're losing until you win. So because Quintet, and if you don't know Quintet, stop this podcast right now, get Fight Pass,
go watch
all
of them.
It's cheap. There's a free trial. Watch Quintet 1 and Quintet 3; they're amazing, and you'll understand this. So it's team battle format, 5-on-5. And if you draw against your opponent in regulation time, you both get eliminated, and the teams move on to the next person on the team. So basically, it's your team eliminates the other person's team, and if you win, you stay on, and the next person from the team comes up, and you have to fight them. So if you lose, a draw is basically a loss.
That's right. And what I love about this, too, is that the way Quintet sets it up is the teams have an overall weight cap. So you can fill that weight cap with five people however you want. You could have five people of the same weight, even, or
in middleweight, like lightweight guys,
fucking huge dude, and a bunch of smaller guys.
You can have a Josh Barnett.
That's right.
On your team, as well as not Satoshi Ishii. I was thinking of Marcus Souza.
Yeah.
Or you can have like a Uriah Faber Gordon Ryan.
That's right.
Where it's like you got to weight your team appropriately so that, you know, you got your big guy, you got your little guy. Like, and then you see freak show matches.
That's
right. You see Gio Martinez versus Hassan Rita, and Gio's able to take it, you know. Yeah. And so Quintet makes gets some really interesting matchups. It also has a fatigue element to it.
Right.
And generally, like,
because if you win, you stay in. If you submit someone, you stay in.
The other thing that I think Quintet does very, very well is they have probably the most aggressive stalling penalties of any professional rule set we have.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They're aggressive, and they've also straight up eliminated positions and submissions that lead to less interesting matches. So no closed guard.
Well, you can hold closed guard, but only for 20 seconds if you're actively working.
Right.
So it's like, that's a good rule, because we don't see anyone ever like sitting and waiting in the closed guard, because the guy in the – it's weird. The guy for IBJJF in the closed guard is the one that's going to get called for stalling if he's not attempting the pass. And I honestly think that usually the guy in the bottom is the one stalling.
Yeah.
So well, it's really interesting. So they basically, Quintet went, nah, catch wrestling. Fuck the clothes guard. You got to sweep.
That's right. And they also got rid of heel hooks.
Yep. So you don't get guys just laying back on a leg. You actually get some attempt at positional control and positional dominance, which it doesn't eliminate the leg locks. We saw Craig Jones knee bar plenty of folk. Yep. We saw Craig Jones, not toe hold, ankle lock, you know,
oh,
Richie
yeah,
Martinez.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't eliminate the leg locks, but because you can't immediately just hold up onto a heel hook, it makes guys really go for a leg lock and like they have to have it because they can't just turn the heel and get a quick sub. I'm not necessarily certain I like that, but for now it's produced some outstandingly exciting matchups.
Right.
And you know, I think that's also partially the grapplers they've selected though.
It is, like, and in part because they selected a very hot submission in Nogi, the heel hook, right?
Right.
Eventually people are gonna get really sick at knee bars. Like I know the 10th Planet guys are, you know, Eddie Bravo was talking about how 10th Planet needs to work on their knee bars.
Talked about that when they ran their team battle thing, didn't they?
He talked about it in general recently, but
okay.
Like, yeah, I think, you know, going into Quintet in general, I could see someone focusing on something else and spamming that. Yeah.
And we've seen some incredible submissions because guys have a much more incentive to work upper body submissions. We've seen some just beautiful stuff that you don't see a whole lot in these submissions because guys can't just fall back for the legs.
That's right.
Or when you do, there you don't have, I'm going to say in quotes, the easy heel hook, but you can't threaten that, so guys have to have additional and different positional control. So it's a rule set that's evolving. I would like to see them find a way to incorporate heel hooks because I think they're a very valid submission, and I don't like the submission being taken away. But I do like not being able to hold a guy in closed guard because it facilitates action.
Right.
That coupled with the aggressive stalling penalties, like, they create action throughout the match. And again, why it's one of the better broadcast events,
right,
for this format. It doesn't, like, you're not going to see, they've had some really slow super fights that, you know, the format just doesn't work as well for because there's not that incentive for action because you get eliminated, okay, you lose your one match as opposed to you lose for your team.
That's
which
right.
I just think has different stakes.
It does. So moving on to the standard for prestige and gi, that's the IBJJF rules.
They have, honestly, I don't want to talk about this too much.
Yeah, I won't.
They have an entire rule book. They update it regularly. That goes into more depth than I ever possibly could go for. It is the gold standard of scoring.
Right.
If you're going to do points, the IBJJF points are the most well-understood point system in jiu-jitsu, hands down. Nothing even comes close.
And even other different systems are really just modifications, you know, just like weighting the points differently. But like the names of the positions and the, you know, overall the structure and hierarchy is determined by IBJJF.
You get 3 points for passing the guard. You get 2 points for sweeping. You get 2 points for neon belly. You get 4 points for back mount with the hooks. You get 4 points for mount.
Right.
Like, that's the gold standard for submission.
Not much to say here, really. Like, that's what it is.
It is what it is. They're probably never going to change their point system.
Yeah. Black belt matches are 10 minutes. I think that's a big... Yep. A big point.
Yeah. I think you get the most, I'm going to in quotes, their technical jiu-jitsu out of this rule set because the points are worth so much. Like, guys can win on, even they have advantages too.
Right.
They can win on very small margins, so you get the most conservative, pressure-heavy jiu-jitsu in IBJJF.
Right.
You know, it's typically the slowest, grindiest jiu-jitsu you're going to see.
Technical.
Yeah, it was very, very, very technical, especially in the gi. Very, very high level, amazing work from the guys, but it's not a rule set. It's not a point system that facilitates action. It's a point system that facilitates control,
right?
Which isn't a bad thing. It's just typically less exciting to watch.
Right.
Like, a guy controlling another guy in half guard for 8 minutes is impressive, but it's not necessarily exciting.
So let's talk about UAE JJF.
You like their rules out a lot.
I fucking love the 6-minute match, man.
So basically, it's the same as IBJJF. They have more aggressive stalling penalties.
That's true.
And
if you piss the sheik off, they come for you.
Yeah. And it's 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Which, when we're covering IBJJF, this... IBJJF,
and there's money, too.
There is money. So yeah, it does a couple things we really like. It's the UAE JJF has monetary... you can win money if you win your division. all the way, I think, from blue belt up. Like, they pay out their competitors. They fly their competitors out. They have six-minute matches, which facilitates action.
Fucking love six-minute matches.
And they have aggressive stalling penalties. So it's like those coupled, you typically see more action at a UAE JJF event than you do at IBJJF event because of the modification of the rule set. And again, only small modifications, but they've made a couple pretty major modifications. Small, I just concentrated myself there. They've made a couple modifications to facilitate additional action and less stalling.
I love him. And my eyeballs feel a little bit less like they want to explode after watching like a whole tournament. So
enjoy the Grand Slam this weekend, Emil.
So let's talk about ACBJJ, the other international major promotion.
We're going to talk about the ACBJJ, the super fight side of their organization, not the amateur tournament side of the organization.
That's right.
And that's what we're talking about for all of these. So some of these also run amateur tournament sides. IBJJF and kind of technically UAEJJF are both kind of amateur events, but we're not going to talk about the more amateur side of ACBJJ.
Right. So ACBJJ has an interesting format. They have 3 5-minute rounds.
I think it's 3 5-minute. But under their title matches are 5 5-minute rounds. So and they do a point system, but they also do rounds. So if you score more than 9 points on your opponent, you get, it's like scored like MMA basically, you get a 10-8 round,
right?
And then so at the end of it, you can win a decision based on the points, or if points are equal, the referee's decision,
right?
So it's basically, if you were to put MMA in a jiu-jitsu rule set, the judging criteria is the same. You rack up points like IBJJF, and then you win rounds by 10 like a 10-point must system.
Right.
So that's how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting format. It started off with probably you and Josh were talking about this, I kind of agreed, like, the best overall events, like whatever that was, ACBJJ 10.
Yeah. They ran some amazing events. They got some amazing level of talent they paid huge amounts of money for, but the people, again, started to learn the rule set, and you saw because they use that IBJJF rule set, you saw a lot more slower matches, very, very high level, very exciting, very good matches, but the action, there's not as much of an incentive to push the pace.
The other
also
thing is, yeah, it's a in a way, it's a 15-minute match, right? Like, it's not exactly,
yeah,
but like,
well,
if you win
any point, any round, you win the match. There's some other organizations that run multiple rounds where if you win, you get points, you get a submission, you get points for that round, and then you keep going. But ACBJJ, if you get a submission in any of the rounds, you are the victor. So,
but people still will plan on having to compete hard for 15 minutes, and so they will be more conservative now.
And you can still play the points game, which is a slower, more grindier game, usually.
So people have figured that metagame out a little bit, and it's slowed down. You know, like, and even the people who run the promotion were complaining about that at one point.
Yeah, the action definitely slowed down. So let's talk about something similar, Polaris.
Yeah.
Polaris also does, in quotes, their rounds, but they do one 15-minute continuous round.
That's right.
So they score the round every 5 minutes, but they don't stop the action. So you look at the first 5 minutes, and then that's scored for who wins who wins, basically. And then you look at the second 5 minutes, and you look at who wins that section. And then you look at the third 5 minutes, and you look at who wins that section. But there's no break in action, which I like a lot, honestly. So it's like a guy can really push the pace for the first 5 minutes, catch kind of a breather the second 5 minutes, and then push the pace and go for the sub hard the last 5 minutes. Like,
you know how I feel about extra time. It's 15 minutes. I consider it, you know, in this case, it is a straight-up 15-minute match. I don't think that improves the quality of jiu-jitsu or the product at the end of the day. I think it just allows for people to slow down for a little bit and then really go ham after a little while. You have a few people who can manage to push the pace the entire time.
Remember, we do have one of the best matches of all time that comes out of this rule set.
Yes, but that's less the rule set and more just throwing Gary Tonin and Usmar Haris in the same fucking room together.
You're not wrong about that. That might be entirely correct. I like, again, this is where personal preference comes in. Like, I enjoy the Polaris style rule set. Like, I enjoy the kind of matches that it facilitates. I also really like their style of matchmaking.
Yeah.
Emil likes you know, his action, his attention, he likes a shorter match time.
Yep.
He thinks there's more done. You just enjoy that more. It's like, yep. And that's where – this is where picking the organizations that you really want to follow comes into play. Yep. And there's nothing wrong with, like, liking a rule set over another rule set. Like, like I like to compete in a submission-only rule set. Emil, I think you would prefer points when you're competing.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with either one of those. It's just a preference.
Yeah.
It's like I love organizations where I can slam guys. Emil, like I think if you were competing, you might not be as down for that.
I could fuck with some slams.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, you learn something every day.
Yeah.
So okay, we're talking about long matches. Let's talk about no time limit submission only. So true submission only, where it will go till someone dies.
Yeah, usually an audience member from boredom.
I like these. You see, from grappling industries is one of the few events that does super fights in this format. I am a fan.
You're
because
fucking crazy.
Because you see, it has to be the right matchup though, and they're not expecting you to watch an entire card of the matchup. Like it is one showcase matchup that they are going to have, and it wins by submission, that's it. It could go 90 minutes. I think Keenan and Gordon went like almost 90 minutes or like 79 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
Or 80. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, Gordon gets the sub and finishes Keenan. And I thought it was a great match. It was super attractive and very interesting to watch. And I enjoyed that matchup.
I would love to ask you that every 5 minutes while watching this. You know.
Oh, no. It's not something I could watch every weekend,
right.
But for certain showcase matchups, I really like the format. Studio 540 did some of these. It wasn't quite no submission only, no time limit, but it was an hour long single round submission only. Very interesting. For the right matches, I'm really happy with it. But again, it's not your preference.
Yeah, I can't do it. I need something to happen, even if it's moving on to the next match. So, but anyway, it's very different. It's how some of the most epic early fights occurred.
The challenge matches, like Kimura. And
right.
Like, there's some outstanding, really, really old school matches that took place in this format.
Definitely part of our heritage in jiu-jitsu. You know, it's part of it.
And, that's weird to think about.
It is.
It's part of our no time submission only till someone dies.
Yeah, no, that is our legacy. It is important to remember that. I just think, in terms of watching week in, week out, it's not tenable.
Yeah. And there's always an argument to be made that it becomes more of an athletic contest at that point, like who can just outlast the other guy. Because especially at a high level, like dudes can go a long time and they pace themselves for an hour match, 2 hour match. Like
yeah.
A guy can't blow through all his gas tank in 5 minutes because that dude might have to go 55 more minutes or
that's right.
75 more minutes.
Yeah.
And it's not unheard of. So. It brings out a different kind of grappling.
Very different. But let's talk a little bit more about like organizational rules with Kasai, right?
Okay.
Kasai has, I love their round robin tournament format.
Yep.
So what they'll do is they'll take.
There's three organizations. There's three off the top of my head, I think, that do this. Kasai, Copapodia, and King of Mats all do round robin tournaments. So typically it's an 8-man bracket. And on either side of the group, you have basically 2 4-person round robin events running, and then the winners of both of those brackets fight each other.
That's right. And so you get different points in each round robin match for either a submission win or a points win or a draw.
Yep.
And
the person with the most points at the end of that round robin goes on to the finals match.
Yeah, from that group, and then the other group sends their top person as well. And so the nice thing about this is it doesn't leave any questions, right? Like it doesn't leave the question, oh man, but what if this person was seated on this side of the bracket?
Yeah,
blah blah
or
blah.
What if it does leave that question because you still have four guys that didn't compete against the other side.
Yeah,
but it leaves less questions than a typical bracket. Like, oh man, you see a dope bracket come out, and then you realize that like there's 6 matchups you want to see, and you might see one of them, and you're like, oh, okay, well it's cool still, but I really wanted to see these guys face each other, but they didn't. With these formats for Kasai, Copodia, King of Mats, you see less of that. Like usually, they seed the matches in a way that you'll want to see them, and it doesn't ask at the end a lot of questions.
Yeah, yeah, it's it's great for that. It's great for like the people who wonder about hypothetical matchups and stuff like that.
But the problems that it could have is there's typically less submissions.
Yep, absolutely.
Because it's a much shorter match. Yep. It's a points match. There is more emphasis on trying to outscore a guy than there is to submit a guy, because you don't necessarily need the 3 points. You just need the 2 points to advance to the finals.
And there's also even more of an incentive for pacing, because you have at minimum three matches to go through,
if not four, right, if you have a finals match.
That's right.
So it's there's a big pacing element here as well. So again, you can get some slower matches, and it's not necessarily as submission friendly as some of the other formats we've talked about. But again, it gives you the opportunity to see a bunch of high level guys go against each other, and you don't miss those matchups. So again, like we talked about, for all of these different rule sets, each one has a pro and a con that it makes it work and makes it not work as well. And it's just finding the flavor that you like the most. Like, I know guys that I train with that absolutely love watching IBJJF, and they're just not into the submission only scene. And I train with guys that are the exact opposite, didn't give a shit about the Worlds this year, but like, they will not miss an EBI.
Yeah.
And it's picking and choosing the format that you want to watch and what gets you the most excited to watch jiu-jitsu.
That's right. Finding someone who excels in that, and then just watching their matches, watch all of them, watch them, watch them in different formats, see which ones kind of pique your interest. You know?
Or you can be an absolute sociopath like we are and watch everything.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, just don't sleep. Just watch grappling all the time.
It is a lifestyle choice. as I look at our schedule approaching us this new year.
Woo, yes, it's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. So yeah, Emil. So after we talked about all this, what is the rule set that? What are some changes to rule sets you think you'd like to see, or what is something that a new rule set you think you could devise from all this you think would produce the jiu-jitsu that you want to see?
So it's interesting that you asked that, because I do feel like the more rules that you add over time, the more it gets gamed, right?
So I would agree, yeah.
So if you put a rule down, eventually someone will figure out how to game it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm very interested in the idea of, and this is going to sound crazy, but like kind of going off of ADCC and other events like that, where the rules change as the match goes on. So it makes
you
it
like that, like points,
well,
no points.
It makes it a little bit harder to.
Emil, you're saying you don't want to watch a round robin, no time limit submission only event.
No,
with 16 man, a 16 man, no time limit event.
No, because that would go for like 3 fucking days.
Yeah, that's not your thing.
No.
Yeah, that could be really interesting.
You know, but that's just me, kind of like just utterly speculating. But
as
like,
but you're a guy that watches again all of these and has watched all of these various rule sets for a while now. Like, you know what you like. And you know what kind of action you're looking to get.
Yeah. I think the concept of overtime, the more that I think about it,
the more that I see it, the more it gets gamed.
Yeah. The more it gets gamed, and like, what do we get out of it? You know, like, you know, in EBI, yeah, might be submissions, but also there might be escape time. You know, so, and then at the end of that, and then there are times where even the overtime, there's no finish.
Right.
You know, what do we get out of
it? I just think, again, I really loved EBI overtime at the beginning. When it first came out, it was exciting, it was entertaining, it was engaging. But now I see it, I've seen too many matches where a dude gets fucked up for regulation time and then is gifted a position, is able to finish or escape. It's like, but I just saw him get, like, trumped.
Yeah.
Like, I personally really like, I'm a big fan of decisions.
Yeah.
Like, I wish, like, 3-person decisions or 5-person decisions. I always think a 1-person decision is weird.
Yeah.
There's a couple that do that. I don't agree with one person, with ref's decision alone.
Right.
I think you need to have ref and judge's decision. Like, I think that is, I think I like the combination of Polaris with the rounds, so you can have longer matches. Like, again, there's things about these I like, and there's things about these I don't like for each rule set. They each have a pro and a con.
I would say that what I'm interested in seeing, well, first is in general, like, definitely overtime, but in general, I would love to see just really short matches. Like, not exactly wrestling length matches, you know, like freestyle wrestling,
right,
where it's whatever, 3 minutes.
2 or 3 minutes. I think it's 3 minutes.
It, you know, that's maybe a little nuts, but like a single four or five minute match. I'm curious just to see what that does in terms of the aggressiveness that we see, because
I think I agree it would be good, especially at a lower level. Like, I honestly think that purple into brown belt is the sweet spot for action, because you get guys that are super hungry, super interested, but at the black belt level, everyone gets so fucking good that it might take a guy a couple minutes to figure out his opponent.
But, like, let's see it, right? Like, let's see a tournament that's, like, a single 4 or 5 minute round. And I'd just love to see that, because I agree that, like, yeah, okay, it takes a little bit of time for a black belt to work. But is that just because they've gotten used to having a lot of time to work? You know, like,
right.
if you restrict them, then they have to game that rule set. And the rule set is you got less time to work.
Right. I've said it for years. I think that you need to have more aggressive stalling penalties. And you need to have clear criteria for what constitutes stalling. Like, not like it's stalling. It's like he's definitely still working super hard on that submission. Like, the Gordon Ryan, I go back to this in Quintet, Gordon Ryan getting stood up from the mount, going for the mounted triangle, arm triangle. It's like, I go back and forth on that, where it's like, oh, it was a terrible stand-up, but also, like, yeah, he wasn't working. He wasn't getting it fast enough. It's like he was sitting there, and he was going for it. But he wasn't getting it. He wasn't advancing. He wasn't isolating it. And, like, he got stood up. Like, it made for a ton of action in that card.
We've all done it. You know, we've all gotten, even in practice, you know, like, you get to that kind of dominant position, and you're just kind of like, all right, I'm going to, like, take a breather.
Emil, I have never stalled on an aggressive blue belt for no reason. What are you talking about with my two bum knees? I have never aggressively got past the guard and laid for all hope to watch the timer until it runs out. What are you talking about, Emil?
Exactly.
So I think you need a combination of all of these. I think a shorter round time would potentially be good.
Right.
I also like Quintet's limitation on the close guard.
Yeah, I like that too.
You either, in a close guard, you should be able to establish it, and then you should have to start to begin to advance position or submit from it in a reasonable amount of time. I think establishing either 20 seconds or 30 seconds, or there needs to be a level of activity that is enforced in the closed guard, and even, I would say, in the half guard.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, you need to have a level of both guys are working. I think also on the feet, you need to have a level of, like, stalling too.
Yeah.
Like, I think if you enforce stalling,
you could stall from open guard, you know, like,
yeah,
you can stall from anywhere.
I think it's harder to stall from open guard though, especially in Nogi, because the passing is there on the top.
Yeah, but
we've seen it. Definitely we've seen it.
Yeah.
But I think that if you have more aggressive stalling penalties on the feet, in the closed guard and in the half guard, and then for the person on top, that you'll facilitate action. And you're going to have to DQ a lot of guys at the beginning before everyone kind of gets, oh, shit, this is what the stalling penalty is. But if you write it out clear in the rules, like, hey, this is what constitutes stalling. And that's going to be a grind and a really hard thing to do. And it's going to be really hard to watch guys at a high level get DQ'd for it. But I think that's where you need to go. Judo did that.
Yeah.
Like, Judo and Greco both have amazingly aggressive stalling penalties and can have amazingly active matches. Judo matches not as much anymore because people have learned how to game that rule set, but, like, you get a lot of action in Greco.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's exactly like, you know, we look at freestyle wrestling, even judo, you know, you get the right stalling penalties and you will get an exciting match. Or, you know, UAJJF, you know, you get some crazy ass Sheik who's just pissed off because people are stalling.
You kind of hung up on that Keenan and
Meow
match.
Yeah. I just, that was actually one of the first times I remember being aware. I can't remember if it was a white or blue belt. I think it was a white belt even. And one of my training partners who's a blue belt was like, yo, did you hear about this? Like, Keenan and Meow just got, you know, DQ'd. And I remember being like, who are these brown belts? Like, and like,
why should I care as a lowly white belt that doesn't know who these guys are?
And now, you know, I'm so familiar with them. But
yeah, now you're like, I wish I could go back and watch that match with what I know now and enjoy it as I know now.
I have a distinct memory, not of watching the match, but of people talking about it. And so that's how you get into jiu-jitsu, is kind of like familiarizing yourself with the rules and then familiarizing yourself with these top level competitors.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, find something you like. Find a guy you like to watch. Like, dude, I love me some Wagner Hosha. Like, I have a list in my head of, like...
Oh, I started writing this down of people that I'm like, oh, I need to watch this motherfucker.
Of, like...
Wagner's on there.
25 guys I have.
Yeah.
That I'm like, if they are on an event or something, I will try to at least keep tabs on, like, how they did.
So, of the non-outliers, yeah, there's Wagner Hosha for me, Mike Padilla, Dante Leone.
Yep.
Mateus Lutz.
Yep.
I'm just trying to think of like the other people.
Krikorian.
Fuck yeah. Oh yeah, Keith Krikorian. Yep. Yep.
I'll watch him.
Yeah.
Who else?
We'll put together a list of these guys, just people to keep an eye on that like
that are super active, super engaging, and super fun.
Might not be like multiple time world champions. Keenan's Maybe the they guy. Will be out at some
Keenan's
point.
Keenan's the guy I'll watch.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Keenan's really good to watch, too.
Especially in the gi, because he just does so much shit that's just like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I don't under... Because it's... Keenan's one of the last guys that is on that level of gi magic I just don't understand yet.
Oh, yeah.
And no. I watch it, and I'm like, oh, my God, he's doing that. Okay, and you watch, and you slowly learn, like, what he's
Dude,
doing.
Dude, I'm still trying to learn what he developed, like, 3 or 4 years ago. You know, like, I'm still not up on my worm guard, you know?
I just try to smash pass through it. It hasn't worked yet. So I'm just going to try to keep meatheading through it and do no-gi.
Yeah, I wonder why your knees are all fucked up.
No, you don't. You know exactly why. I have video of both knees popping, by the way.
I
have the video
that.
Of the first one from security camera when I got the when I knee-barred myself. And I have video from the tournament when I popped it out in X-guard.
Well, take care of yourself, man.
I'm going to try. So you got anything else on rules, Emil?
That's it.
Awesome. So that pretty much does it for our second bonus episode.
Yeah.
If you like these, let us know. If you don't like these, let us know. But we're probably going to keep doing them regardless. you cannot listen. That's on you. If you've made it this far, that's on you.
We might switch up topics and stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. If you have topic suggestions for us, like let us know, because we don't get an opportunity to do these bonus episodes very frequently. But as our schedule opens up and as we have time here and there, like I'm definitely up for doing them. Like. The topics are not as time sensitive,
right.
So if you have something you'd like to hear us talk about that's related to sport jiu-jitsu, not as much of like the mentality stuff and like really those are questions for like the competitors.
Right.
Like Emil and I, we cover this and enjoy it, but I don't think we are the best guys to answer those kind of questions, but like rule set questions and event questions and pacing questions.
If you have something or if you have something that requires a little bit more time, like that needs a little bit of research or delving into, you know, that could be great for these things. So
yeah, so let us know what you have for topic suggestions. We have a small list going, and you know, as we get more time to do these bonus episodes, we're going to try to do that again in 2019, trying to put out a little more content and just, you know, continue to grow the show and do what we've been doing, but trying to put out a good product that is enjoyable to listen to and not fucking terrible.
Yeah.
So as always, I've been Maine.
I've been Emil,
and this is the Grappling Rewind. See you on the mats. If you like the show, please consider sharing it on Facebook with the folks at your gym. It's the best way that we grow the show, and we really appreciate it. You can reach out to us on email.
We also have Instagram. We have Facebook. We have Twitter. We have Google+.
Until that shuts down.
We have a website.
If you have an event you would like to have us cover, please let us know. If you have a name, like most people do, and you'd like to have us stop butchering it,
let us know.
Reach out to us. The show is also available on YouTube, Spotify, in addition to iTunes and every other podcast service. We very much appreciate your time, and thank you.